Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Veteran journalist Lisa Anderson has filed stories from here, there, and everywhere. The United States, Europe, Asia, Africa. She spent 25 years at the Chicago Tribune as a correspondent and New York bureau chief. Her beat, major disasters, from the Oklahoma City bombing to Columbine. And as a result, she trained other journalists in disaster reportage. Before the Tribune, Lisa was a fellow at the Columbia Journalism Review at New York's Columbia University. Currently, Lisa is the North American correspondent for the Thomson Reuters Foundation, reporting on humanitarian and anti-corruption issues, women's rights, and good governance. Lisa was hired in September 2010 to develop Trust Law Women, a global news site. In 2012, the foundation started an annual conference, Trust Women, to explore ways in which to put the rule of law behind women's rights through concrete action. The women's rights editor, Lisa, developed a new online hub for Trust Law that incorporates content, news, and information about women's legal rights and issues. A list of her blog topics include: could equal pay threaten women's marriage prospects? Girls for Sale, A Day in the Life, Ethics Missing in Debate on Climate Change, and New Abolitionist Anti-Slavery Campaign Launches in New York. Lisa, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy, for having me.
Let's work backwards. How and why did you become a journalist?
You know, I was thinking about that, and it seemed like I always wanted to be a journalist. But I remember distinctly growing up, and there was a show on TV called In the Name of the Game, and it was about a Time magazine-like magazine based in Los Angeles. And I just loved the idea of going out and reporting stories. And the funny thing was, that was in the 70s, and the character I most identified with was a researcher. And in those days, that was what a lot of women
did.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So I started out thinking, oh, I want to be a researcher at Time magazine.
Because in the show, there were no female reporters.
No.
So did you?
No. I did become a researcher at WCBS-TV as I was working my way through college here in New York. Mm-hmm. But then I knew that I could also be a reporter. So that was a step up the ladder. And I went on staff at WCBS-TV while I was still in college. And then I went from there to Women's Wear Daily. I was a print reporter for fashion news, not fashion criticism, but fashion news, manufacturing, retailing, things like that.
Would you be covering Fashion Week?
I would, but not in those days. I would be writing it in terms of the reaction from retailers, what they liked, what they were going to buy, how much. And then we also had W Magazine, which still exists, mm-hmm. for which I did features. And those would be television personalities, theater personalities, homes, shelter, design. It was a variety of things.
Was it difficult to transition from one job to another?
No, it really wasn't that difficult to make the transition because reporting is reporting.
Right.
And as a researcher, I was used to researching things. So when I got to Fairchild, I think the hardest thing was, by day, we had the same staff in those days for both Women's Wear Daily and W. Mm-hmm. And Women's Wear Daily, as people always ask me, was it daily? Yes, it was daily. So that was a daily newspaper. They call it the Bible of the fashion industry.
Sure.
And for that, we were straight news reporter. I was a straight news reporter. But then at the same time, we were also feature writers doing interviews. And my first foreign assignment was for W. I went to Barbados and interviewed Claudette Colbert, among
wow.
other things. So you were living kind of two lives. You were a straight news reporter doing mostly business, or I was, during the day. But at the same time, you were a feature writer doing these incredible stories about incredible people.
So that's kind of glamorous, isn't it?
It was glamorous, and it was very funny. Most of us were as poor as church mice, so we went home at night to these ridiculous apartments. And then during the day, we were telling, you know, Brooke Astor, you know, I really, Mrs. Astor, I think you need to move that cash pot to the left for the photo.
What a contrast.
It was, but John Fairchild, who's now in Switzerland, was a fantastic teacher, as crazy as a loon, if you'll forgive me, Mr. Fairchild, but brilliant. And so he really taught you how to see things. And I think that was the most important thing I learned, was how to look at things, whether it was a dining table that we were going to photograph, or how a person reacted, you know, body language. So you really, I learned a great deal. It was difficult and it was hard work, but we all learned a lot. And almost everyone went on to do really interesting things. Ben Brantley, who's now the chief theater critic for the New York Times, was one of the reporters with me in those days.
So that's where you basically cut your teeth. I'm not excluding WCBS,
right. Yes.
But researching is one thing. Writing is a whole other ballgame.
Yes, absolutely.
And how long were you there?
I was there for 7 years.
And then what happened? Did you go right to the Tribune?
My husband was working for CBS. He was transferred to Chicago in 1983 to run the station there. He had already once been the news director there. I commuted every week with a dachshund. And
aye,
so
aye, aye.
We did that for, I think, 2 years. Then he came back to New York, and then he was transferred again to be the general manager. To run the station. So at that point, I thought, I'm not going to push my luck. I'm going to move. So I left Fairchild, and I went to Chicago without a job, but with a freelance kind of understanding with Women's Wear Daily and W.
And was the Chicago Tribune basically your first job in Chicago?
It was, and it came in a funny way because I literally had just gotten to Chicago. We had just bought an apartment. The day we had the phone put in, there was no furniture in the apartment. I was there, like, measuring things.
Standing.
And the phone rang, and this lady on the phone said, "Hi, my name is Colleen Deshaun. I'm with the Chicago Tribune." And I said, "Oh, thank you. We already subscribed, you know."
And she goes, "We get the paper."
"Yeah, no, we did, and we had." And she said, No. She said, "You don't understand." She said, "I understand you've moved to Chicago, and a colleague of mine in New York said you might be right for a job we have open."
Those things make me crazy.
Yeah.
And that's really how it just happened.
It just happened
serendipitously.
That way. Totally.
What was the job?
Well, I thought the job was a general features reporter, but what it really was they wanted a fashion writer. They had a lead fashion writer, but they were building their presence in fashion, so they needed another one. And actually, I was hired under false pretenses because I didn't want to be a fashion writer anymore,
mm-hmm.
but I ended up being one. And the lead fashion writer became ill. They called me in the beginning of August. I was hired on the 15th of August, and that October, I guess it was, the lead fashion writer who went to Paris became ill, and so I was in Paris reviewing fashion shows.
Wow.
So,
stuff that you just don't plan for. Isn't that crazy how life plays out?
But what I did, and this is a good thing for if someone young is interested in how to make more of a job,
mm-hmm.
I realized it wasn't enough for me to just review fashion shows. I mean, that wasn't my forte to begin with, but I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody really can do it, but some people do it better than others.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was great.
Okay.
But I wanted to do more, so I realized on that trip I did other feature stories about design. I remember doing a story about Louis Vuitton and how they make their fabulous, you know, stuff, and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that was the way to make that more rewarding. And so the next season, I realized the lead fashion writer is going to Paris. But I said, if you really want to build your fashion coverage, you should go to Milan, because I knew all this from Women's Wear. And I said, you know, and I'd like to go.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me. And I did the same thing. I did other stories about food, design, shelter, personalities. And then when I came back, I said, if you really want to build your fashion coverage, you should cover London. Because in the 80s, the early 80s, London was a really important fashion resource. It's wobbled back and forth a lot since then.
Mm-hmm.
But at that moment, it was Boy George, and it was,
okay.
you know, the punks and rockers and the mohawk hair and all that. So they sent me. And so I then built that into twice-a-year trip to Milan and London, and every other trip I would do an extra week doing feature stories in either England or Italy.
So how do you move from fashion to disasters?
I always say to people, I sort of took a wrong turn, and I went from kind of the Via Monte Napoleone in Milano to, you know, wearing a flak jacket, you know. Around 1992, the managing editor approached me about becoming bureau chief in New York, which was quite shocking to a lot of people because I was a feature writer and I had covered fashion. And in those days, which are not so long ago, those were considered very fluffy, frivolous topics. And plus, I was a woman.
I was just going to go there. Now, how many female bureau chiefs were there?
There weren't a lot in those days. There still aren't that many, but many more now. But it was shocking. And at first I thought, my first question was, can I still go to Europe? You know? And at first he said, yes, you know, you can for a while. But very slowly but surely, I started enjoying hard news. And there's a lot, I know this sounds strange, but there's a great deal in common with covering fashion and covering politics and even wars, because it's the contrast between people's expectations and their aspirations that are behind a lot of these things. And in a weird way, if you really apply yourself, the skills are very similar. So I progressed into politics. Then I began to cover disasters. And that wasn't by design. I was assigned, my first disaster was Oklahoma City.
Wow. So you and your husband moved back to New York,
yes,
right?
Yes. At a certain point, my husband was named president of CBS News.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he was named president of CBS News around January. He was appointed. And so I thought, well, I can't ask these people to send me to New York. I mean, I'm barely here. And Fairchild was nice enough to call me. They had just bought Inc. magazine.
Uh-huh.
And they were merging it with M magazine at that time. And they said, you know, we have a slot for someone to do profiles of, you know, business people, which is one of the things I did well in those days. And so I thought about it, and I went to my editor, and I said, you know, everyone in Chicago knew my husband had been named CBS News chief. And I said, you know, I don't expect you to keep me. So I have this offer. You know, what do you think? And they said, no, we'd like you to stay. We'd like you to move to New York. So I moved to New York
and
for
run the New York bureau.
Well, no, not yet. I still was a feature writer.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so I did that until I did that for about 9 years.
Wow.
Feature writing.
Then you wound up training other reporters in disaster reporting,
right.
Correct?
Well, once you start doing disasters, I mean, it was Oklahoma City, it was Columbine, things like that. After you do a few, if you're of a mind for it, which is saying something. I mean, you don't know it until you do it, whether you can
handle it well.
Then, and as I was becoming a more senior correspondent, then I would start doing not so much training as heading up groups of people. Like at Columbine, I headed up a group of people who were covering that event. And it's you're basically making sure everything's covered, all the bases, so to speak, but also keeping an eye on people, because it may not be the most vulnerable, obvious person who's having a hard time. It may be someone quite a bit older.
Mm-hmm.
You just never know.
Right.
So you're also watching them to make sure they're okay.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lisa Anderson. She's a North American correspondent for the Thomson Reuters Foundation. And that's a good segue for me, because when I first started out back in the 80s, Reuters was a news wire service. When did it become Thomson Reuters Foundation?
That's a great question. It's not. Reuters became Thomson Reuters in about 2008. The Reuters news service that we all know,
yes,
merged with Thomson, which is basically a legal information and product service. It comes out of Canada. And what happened was both of them had philanthropic ventures, arms, and they had to figure out how do we create a new philanthropic arm that represents the strengths of both Thomson and Reuters, which then became Thomson Reuters Corporation. So a woman who's currently my big boss, Monique Villa, a French woman, who had been a journalist at Agence France-Presse and also had worked at Reuters running their media service, was appointed to figure out how to create a foundation that would represent the journalism strength of Reuters and the legal strength of Thomson. So she developed the idea of trust law, because Reuters works on what we call the trust principles, and they're obvious. It's like accuracy, integrity, so on. And so trust is a byword at Reuters, and law is law. And we already had AlertNet, which covered humanitarian news and was born in after the Rwandan genocide in about 1994 or 5. But she wanted to expand, obviously, into something more with law. So she created the first so-called vertical on the site, in addition to AlertNet, was for anti-corruption good governance. And then she wanted to expand further into women's rights, and that's when I was hired. But Thomson Reuters Foundation is independent of Thomson Reuters Corporation. It receives funding from it, but it's a separate entity that has its own brief. I joined them in 2010. But in 2008, a year that shall live in journalistic infamy, there were thousands and thousands of journalists either bought out or laid off around the country. You may recall, it was after the recession, after Lehman Brothers, things were really bad. And things were really bad at the Chicago Tribune because a guy named Sam Zell, who was a real estate magnate in Chicago, had purchased the entire Tribune company and taken it private. And in those days, the entire Tribune company included the Los Angeles Times, the Baltimore Sun, Newsday, the Chicago Tribune.
Wow, what a conglomerate.
The Orlando Sun Sentinel, and so on. It was very large, plus a whole array of television stations. So he bought it, took it private, and although Zell was very talented in the real estate world, he was a bit of a, how shall I say, thuggish character. He was really, and he took pride in that. He was very rough-spoken. He was famous for spouting off expletives. And the Tribune culture had been one that was very kind of buttoned up. So this was a big culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
He also claimed that he saw no need for international news, even though he was a man with business interests around the world. And so he really started changing not only the culture, but the way things were going. And under Zell, basically, there was a plan to close all of the Tribune's national and foreign bureaus and supplant them with coverage from the LA Times.
Huh.
And that was just one of the many changes.
So you saw the writing on the wall.
I read the writing on the wall, absolutely. And I also knew that anyone who got out within a year of Zell's purchase, he purchased the company in December of 2007. So December of 2008 was a cutoff. Until 2008, December 31st, anyone who left the company was guaranteed 2 weeks' pay per year of service in terms of a buyout or severance. After that, all bets were off.
Right.
And I could see what was coming. I mean, I knew it. And so I asked for a buyout. I got the buyout. I got 2 weeks per year of service, which in my case was almost a year because I'd worked there 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I got it on December 3rd, and the company declared Chapter 11 on December 8th.
Wow, that's wild. Wow.
So it was very sad. I was really sad to leave, but it was one of those, and this is something to remember too for people. Sometimes what you're leaving isn't what it was.
Of course.
And so in a way, it was easier to leave because I was watching the newspaper I loved really being destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So you get this new offer.
Well, first it was just to build their women's rights site, which didn't exist because Monique was still building. She had come there.
You were going to work with her?
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I was going to work in New York because the foundation wanted to expand its global footprint. And at that point, and still, the foundation is based in London. That's where all of our top editors are. That's where our headquarters are. We had some correspondents then starting in Bangkok and a few elsewhere, but it was still building, and we didn't have any correspondents in the U.S.
So that became your role?
That was my role. My role was basically first to build the women's rights site.
And how'd you do that?
It was a miracle, Sandy, because I had no idea what I was doing, not even a clue.
Really?
Really, because although I was interested in women's issues and I covered women's issues, but in a very general way in
sure.
the course of my work, I was no expert on it, A. B, I was not the most technologically advanced creature in the world. So the idea that I was going to build a website was, or a vertical in this case, was...
So you felt you were definitely in over your head.
I thought so, but at the same time, by then I'd seen what people had been going through. In between, I spent a year at the Columbia Journalism Review writing articles, and I was watching what was happening to journalists around the country, and I realized you had to reinvent yourself because journalism, as we all knew it, especially in the print version,
right.
was completely changing, would never be the same again, might get better. But at that point, we didn't know when, mm-hmm. if ever. So I thought, well, you know, whatever it is, I can do this. I'll figure out a way to do this. And it was hard. But I started making contacts. I started seeing people. I knew I had to get content partners who would help us with content because we couldn't supply all of the content ourselves.
What was the bent? What were you going for?
I was going for a way to fulfill Monique's mission, which was that in everything we do, we also represent a legal aspect. So I was looking for covering women's rights and issues, but always with the idea of laws in the background. So, which is not hard because almost every issue having to do with women's rights or issues has something to do with law, whether it's abortion, whether it's contraception. Now we're looking at should the Hobby Lobby
right.
be forced to provide a contraceptive
for
coverage?
Their employees, right?
Or is it child marriage? Is it inheritance rights? You know, so I just kept looking for things and people who could contribute to us in a way that pulled in that legal aspect as well as the social and the economic. I mean, really, all aspects, but legal was always at the heart of it.
So give some specifics.
Well, for example, when I was building it, one of the things we wanted to do was to see if we could collect a database on laws around the world pertaining to women. So I went to Washington and I talked to the ABA, which had a division on women.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up partnering with them for a while because they, too, were trying to collect a database on laws regarding women. We've gone past that now in a way, but that's the kind of thing we were looking for.
But what are laws regarding women?
And
they vary so from country to country.
And that's why it's almost impossible to gather every law,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was, for example, remember we're global.
Yes.
So it's not just the U.S.
Right.
So it would vary from what are inheritance laws in Kenya, and always with the idea, too, that laws around the world, you can have, and you must have the law. The law is the beginning, but it's often not the end because cultural traditions and norms will almost always trump civil law in a lot of societies, particularly in Africa and Asia. So you may have a law that a woman should inherit the land if her husband dies.
Right.
But in that village, if the tradition is when the husband dies, his brothers get the land, or his father or whoever, or male cousins, then that's what usually is going to prevail because local law that's implemented by village chiefs or whatever will almost always trump civil law still.
So your role was to
expose but also write stories about, illustrate.
And the hope of change.
Well, that's at the end of the day, I mean, what we're looking for is impact.
Impact,
we're looking, if we can. It's very hard to do, but that's your goal at the end of the day. You really want the stories to illustrate problems, maybe offer solutions through the voices of the people on the ground who are working with these problems in the hopes that maybe things will change. And sometimes they do.
And when do they? Give me a couple of examples.
Well, for example, one of my colleagues who's in Senegal had done a story, I think it was on inheritance rights, and a woman, you know, was denied her rights, blah, blah, blah. And later, after his story ran, a letter appeared, you know, on the prime minister's desk saying this is wrong, from someone important, and they looked into it, and it's started to cause change.
Mm-hmm,
and we've had that happen a number of times.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lisa Anderson. She's a North American correspondent for the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and you have correspondents all over the world.
The foundation has its own correspondents. We have three in the U.S., two in New York, one in D.C., who specializes in corruption. We have Bogota, Colombia. We have they're all fabulous correspondents. One's in Dakar, Senegal. One's in Nairobi. Two are in Bangkok. And one is in New Delhi. One is in Rome, specializing in food security, which is a new area for us. We're hoping to get another correspondent in South America this year. And we're aiming to get one in the Middle East, North Africa region. And those are correspondents who work for the foundation.
And their works are published through Thomson Reuters Foundation.
Well, they're published on our site.
Your site, yes.
But yes, also they're picked up by Thomson Reuters Wire
service.
So, and then we also draw on Reuters' thousands of correspondents around the world. But they are still writing primarily about financial and political matters, not so much about the kinds of things we cover. In fact, we say the foundation covers the world's underreported stories. Because, and that's also a commentary on journalism in general, because years ago, Human Rights Watch could pick up the phone and say, we have a great report now on child marriage. You know, are you interested in writing about it? And you'd say, sure. Nowadays, very few places, including the New York Times even, have enough people available
yes.
to cover these things.
As I was doing research about you, sex trafficking and...
That's a big issue for
and
us.
And this article that you recently wrote, Disgraced Anti-Sex Slavery Crusader Mom Unveils Plan for a New Group. I mean, this right. is a fascinating story.
Yes,
would
it
you
is.
Just talk a little bit about that? You tell it rather than me.
Okay, well, I'll try to make it brief because it is a saga. But there was a very famous anti-sex trafficking activist in Cambodia. Her name is Somali Mom. She has nothing to do with Somalia, so it's very confusing.
Right.
And it souns like Somali Man, like man.
Yeah, hey, man.
But it's not.
Yeah.
It's M-A-M.
Right.
And she was a very charismatic figure, beautiful woman. And her story, her personal story, which she wrote in her autobiography, talks about how she was trafficked into sex slavery as a young girl, spent years in a brothel.
In Cambodia, right?
In Cambodia, mm-hmm. in Phnom Penh. And then eventually she met a Frenchman, I believe, married him and was liberated from a life of prostitution and then decided to create her own foundation to help girls who are in sex traffic situations. And that was great. And that went on for years. She became the toast of all kinds of very fancy circles around the world. And there had been rumors that things weren't quite
kosher,
as she said, right, but nothing concrete. And the only way you could ever have known was if you literally backtraced her story on foot in Cambodia. And so a reporter from Cambodia who had been watching her, a Western reporter, decided to write a story for Newsweek and backtrack. And, you know, he claims, and I have no reason to think he didn't, to go back step by step with her story.
Mm-hmm.
And it all kind of fell apart. According to him, the timelines didn't match. She said her parents, she hadn't seen her parents as a girl for years. A village chief in the village where she was grew up originally said he saw her with her parents in X years. Those were the years she was supposed to be in the brothel. Girls that she claimed had been, you know, terribly mistreated turned out, like one girl had lost an eye, but it wasn't due to abuse by a John. It was due to an eye infection.
So it was all falling apart, huh?
It all fell apart, and he documented it step by painful step. I mean, it was really a litany of disgrace. And that was in May, and she didn't respond to any questions, but her own foundation, which is based here in the United States, they hired an outside law firm to do its own investigation because they were concerned before the Newsweek story came out. And apparently the outside law firm came to the same conclusion.
Wow.
So Somali Mom abruptly resigned. And the foundation thought it could go on.
But fell apart.
But fell apart also. And that was sort of the end of it. And then Somali Mom refuted all the charges in a Marie Claire article. But then now you're at the point of he said, she said. Because
right.
the only way I would know the truth, I believe, is if I personally went back to Cambodia and I backtracked myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
you just don't know exactly who's right.
Sure.
But clearly something was terribly wrong or she wouldn't have resigned.
Exactly.
And the foundation would not have hired the outside counsel to investigate. So something went terribly wrong. So we thought that was it. And then all of a sudden she's back.
Reinventing herself.
Yeah, right before Christmas. She announced that she was going to go back in business, but no longer rescuing girls as she had before, instead rehabbing them, teaching them how to be self-sustaining, employment opportunities, trying to get them integrated into the hospitality, so to speak, industry, not the bad one,
right.
more the Marriott type of one, which is a booming industry in Cambodia and a lot of these areas where there are ruins and there are lots of tourists. So that's the plan now. But it was a real shock in the development community that all of this.
So there really is an eclectic type of reporting here,
absolutely.
which is really fascinating. What's unfortunate is we've run out of time. And we could go on and on. Your life is so interesting and the work you do so fascinating.
Thanks, Sandy. It was great to be here.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Lisa. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.